Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we've got a great episode and show here for you tonight with a full crew of our semi-regular and regular folks on the show, which is always nice to have the core team back together again. And of course, that the glue that holds that all together is Sam Bradley.
Well, it is good to have everybody back, and that's particularly hard in the summer when people are traveling. And of course, Joe's always off doing his thing, and Kyle's teaching and working. And we also have our friend Kevin here with us tonight from Wild Safety, and we're going to have a little bit of fun. But first, we want to talk about the weather, of course. So, Kyle, hurricane season is stirring up. What's going on with that presently, given the fact that we probably will have this recorded a bit earlier than it will be put up? So bear that in mind. But we also want to kind of look at what you know yet of the longer range hurricane forecast.
Oh, sure, Sam. And hello, everyone, on the Disaster Podcast. Meteorologist Kyle Nelson coming to you remote this evening. So apologize for the audio quality. However, we will get into the nitty-gritty of hurricane things here a little bit later on in the episode. Again, this being recorded a little bit sooner or a little bit earlier than this actually airing. But the big theme has been flooding. That's not just the ongoing flooding we have in the Dakotas and western Illinois and the southern Mississippi River Valley, but most notably here just last week, Washington Reagan National Airport, 3.3 inches of rain in just 1 hour, resulting in a flash flood emergency across the city. And so the atmosphere was juiced with so much moisture, got all squeezed out, rained out over that particular area, resulted in prolific flash flooding impacts. Areas and seeing many people posting their stories on social media saying that we never thought we lived in an area that could flood. We never knew we were in a flood plain. And so that really talks about how these urban areas can amplify flooding, and compound that with people making bad decisions can ultimately lead to very poor outcomes. Just to on the numbers, at least 43 people have died in the U.S. while driving into floodwaters just in 2019. And it just angers me to no end because all those deaths are preventable. Looking now into from flood into the fire side of things, New Mexico, Arizona, heating up at the moment with the most active wildfire conditions. Drought conditions actually quickly developing across the Pacific Northwest, so we may see wildfire starts up there pretty soon, as well as some late-season flooding in the central mountains of Colorado, as we still actually have quite a bit of snow up high in the mountains there that actually flooded out a few communities in remote communities in the Rocky Mountains. But to kind of pivot now and look at things, we've only had one named storm system in the Atlantic so far this hurricane season at the time of recording here on July 9th. However, we may be talking about Barry, which is the second name for the Atlantic Basin, if we do have a named storm coming up soon. But just pause and kind of open up the floor before we jump into the hurricane discussion.
Well, it's interesting, Kyle, because the people in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, I find it interesting they weren't aware that it could flood there, considering the city is built essentially on a drained swamp. So all that area around the Potomac and that part of Maryland is pretty low-lying and high water table area. So it's just interesting. But I guess, put 3 inches of rain anywhere in an hour, it's going to be a lot.
Oh, absolutely. And for anyone listening, that's a fact. That's not a political statement that Jamie just made.
Yeah, I'm not talking about the draining of that swamp. That's a whole other issue.
That's right.
I'm not touching that. Dr. Joe, how are things down in Memphis? Any questions on what Kyle's been talking about?
No, I'm sure it's coming. We just got our official prediction through FEMA that talked about this being an average hurricane season. That's it's hard to know what that's really worth. Obviously, predicting the weather way beyond a few days at this point in time is pretty challenging, but sounds like it's looking at the weather patterns, looking like a more regular hurricane season for us as opposed to anything too scary.
Well, I guess that's good. Kevin Ryder, how are things down in Texas? Still hot, I assume?
Hot and very humid, which is the status quo for July in Texas.
Yeah, 10-4 on that. So, Mr. Kyle, any more hurricane stuff we want to share that you know of yet?
Well, as Joe hinted at, the official prediction, and then there are several entities that put these out. The one he referenced was from the National Weather Service, their hurricane prediction, and again, calling it the verbiage they use is a near normal Atlantic hurricane season for 2019. And I encourage folks, again, don't get hung up on the vernacular there. Just know that we have the greatest chance, when if we look at this in probabilities, of experiencing a near normal hurricane season. We hinted at this a couple episodes back, but anywhere from about 9 to 15 named storms, and as well as 4 to 8 hurricanes, 2 of 4 may become major hurricanes. And that's looking very, very long range from a whole host of factors. But even as we're going to talk about here, just right after this, it only takes one system. And I'll tell you what, folks, it doesn't even need to have a name associated with it to really ruin your day and cause widespread impacts.
Well, it sounds like Joe will be responding to some flooding events. And something you said, sorry, I got a four-month-old puppy in here. Something you said earlier resonates with me. Never say never. Agreed?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even look at August 2016 in southern Louisiana. You know, they wasn't even a named storm that resulted in widespread flash flooding and many deaths. The storm never, ever had a name, but produced prolific rainfall and widespread impacts. So absolutely, Sam, never say never. But as we've hinted at now, kind of jumping into the meat of things here, again, we're recording this about 2 weeks before it's going to air. But as we look at things right now, there is a broad low pressure area or area of unsettled weather that's currently sitting over the Florida Panhandle there in the northeastern Gulf of Mexico. It's got some widespread but very disorganized rain showers and a few thunderstorms embedded in it. The big thing is that this is actually expected to develop into at least a tropical depression, if not perhaps something more potent as we go on later this current week that we're recording and even through the weekend. Now, the big thing is that the greatest impact being projected and communicated is heavy rainfall, right? Historically, many think, oh, well, you think of this tropical system, well, you assume that it's drifting from, you know, the Gulf of Mexico into the southeastern U.S., right, heading to the north and to the east, but this is actually the other way around. So it's kind of a mind bender, right? So this system actually had its origins in the Rocky Mountains as some individual thunderstorms that grew very, very large, and they actually merged together. And the term that's used for that is what we call an MCV in the weather community, or a mesoscale convective vortex. So essentially, this is a kind of a swirling area, and these thunderstorms, they come together and kind of become a living, breathing system, if you will, that actually have spin, so they have rotation, they have ample moisture, and they have energy with them. And so now as that's drifted southeast from the Rocky Mountains to the Florida Panhandle, that area of unsettled weather, that's one of the first ingredients that we need to develop a tropical system. So just a quick review, we're looking for a pre-existing disturbance. So whether that's a cluster of thunderstorms like this is, which is perfect, there's warm ocean water, more than 80 degrees Fahrenheit, that is well above that in the Gulf of Mexico currently. There's plenty of moisture there, and there's also very low amounts of vertical wind shear. So the winds at the middle and upper levels of the atmosphere are actually relatively calm, and that's actually all feeding together to result in the formation of this tropical system as it's projected to as we go later on into the week. So you may also be wondering, too, for some of our listeners, is this kind of typical for July, you know, tropical system where we would expect it to form? And the answer is absolutely yes. So if we look back, say over the last, the entire hurricane record from 1851 up until now, in the first 10 days of July, we're looking at the Eastern Pacific, the Gulf of Mexico, and the Western Atlantic as the biggest points for these tropical systems to form. And so it's actually forming where we would expect for this time of year, just in a way that we might not always expect.
Just wow. You know, one of the things I remember you talking about with some of the nastier storms in the last couple of years was the fact that so many of them went so far inland and dumped rain and flooding and created flooding where people didn't expect to see it, because I kind of assume it's all going to do its damage around the Gulf Coast. Do you want to comment to that real fast?
Yeah, definitely. That's something that, you know, everyone may think that, and there's the misconception perhaps that, well, I don't live on the coastline. I don't live in a floodplain that I know about, perhaps. And in addition to all that, well, these weather systems, they're here and then they're gone, right? Because that's what I have experienced personally when rainfall has occurred. But what we're seeing, and research supports this, and our evolving climate also supports this, is that these tropical storm systems, tropical cyclones, so that's tropical depressions, tropical storms, and hurricanes, have started to actually move slower and persist for longer, kind of dwell over areas for longer. So that energy, once that tropical depression, tropical storm, or hurricane, once that hits the shoreline, yes, the characteristics of it may change and how we refer to it in the meteorological community may change, but the impacts don't. All that energy, all that moisture, that still goes up with that system. And so you can get, you know, insane amounts of rain, even very, very far inland. Now, also think about, we still have active flooding going on in the Southern Mississippi River Valley. And over this weekend into the coming week, that's where the heaviest rainfall is expected to occur with this system in the Gulf, whether or not it gets a name or not. So now we have tropical rainfall from a slow-moving tropical cyclone on top of river flooding that's already in place from snowmelt in the northern plains, as well as continued runoff from heavy rainfall that's occurred in the central and southern U.S. So there's a lot coming together, Sam, that could really result in some nasty impacts.
And Kyle, I have a question just to think, because one of the comments I saw, and of course this is, I think some of this is hype, you know, looking at potential for what's happened in the past, but a slow moving storm sitting just off the coast in the Gulf is exactly what dumped 50 inches of rain on Houston. Is this anticipated to bring in that kind of rainfall, or is this something that's going to be a lesser event? Not that it's not going to be significant in its own way.
Well, Jamie, right now it's too early to put that the numbers on rainfall. Right now we're looking to see if this cluster of storms with that low pressure system is going to indeed develop into a tropical cyclone, and if it gets a name and as it intensifies, where exactly it's going to go. There is quite a lot of uncertainty right now, since it's moving so slowly, exactly where it's going to go once it forms and gets a little bit more structure. And so from that, again, the greatest impacts for rainfall, they're looking at, you know, the Florida Panhandle up into along the southern, you know, Mississippi River there. But the exact numbers at this point are really hard to say, because we really need to see how that storm develops and where it's going to track. Not until tomorrow will the hurricane hunters begin flying, which then gives us those point observations within that cluster of storms and gets us the data that we need and those measurements we need to feed into our weather models so we can make those better predictions.
And so that's all a lot of just speculation and concern, but it's not something that can really be decided at this point. And I think it's important to note that, since this episode will come out 2 weeks from when we're talking about it, you know, this is going to be a decided issue for people listening to this, but I think it's important for people listening to understand that, you know, we'll when you're listening to this, you'll know the impact from this storm already. But I think it's important to understand that we are talking about still trying to prepare for the worst. And then if it's not as bad as we expect it to be, or, you know, can plan for it to be, then that's okay. But I think this is another situation where, you know, we're going to be talking about preparedness, but hindsight that you're going to have as listening to this episode should give you some insight as to why we talk preparedness all the time.
Very true. Joe, any thoughts from you so far?
Well, Kyle's right on the money. You know, Memphis is pretty close to flood stage already. Our Riverside Park is partially underwater and has been for several weeks now. And the Mississippi is probably a mile and a half wide here at Memphis. So, you know, there's a lot of water in the system already, and this is just gonna add more at a time when we really don't need it.
That's the way it works. Kevin?
Yeah, pretty much exactly. Kyle, as always, is pretty much spot on. And it'll just be interesting to see what the outcome will actually be. And, of course, we don't know until it happens. But in the meantime, just stay prepared.
Yes, and that is our theme for tonight. In fact, we're going to kind of move the weather discussion into this. We were, Kevin and I, a few weeks ago, were looking at scenarios, and most of which actually occurred, and some that he personally experienced. And we kind of want to have everybody comment on these in terms of what went well, what didn't go well, what people could have done differently to change the outcome. So, Kyle, I'm going to start with you on this one. So your ski patrol has been asked to help find this man who has been missing for almost a month. And he supposedly went from point A to point B, which came right through your area. But he didn't tell anybody exactly where he was going. And of course, the snow came in, and that's another element. But they knew that there was a problem when one of his parents actually died, and they could not get a hold of him. So let's assume you find this man in his car, who's been there for a significant amount of time, in a place where civilization was basically 4 miles away. What would you expect to find?
Wow, that's a fantastic scenario. For me, I would, goodness, Sam, for me personally, if just going off the cuff with no other information, I would more than likely expect to find this person probably in either a hypothermic state or possibly even deceased, especially depending on the supplies that he had, the training that he came with, as well as if he was able to run that vehicle and for what amount of time. So I'm thinking hypothermic to possibly fatality.
Well, you're exactly right. That in fact, did happen. He was hypothermic, and basically starvation was a factor in his demise. He chose not to get out of the car, not realizing that civilization was just 4 miles away. What are your thoughts on leaving your vehicle in a situation like that with the hopes of maybe finding help if there's nothing you can do, you have a limited amount of food and water, et cetera?
Sure. So when it comes to that, as many of us hopefully have learned or will learn possibly from this, is that if you become lost, the best thing is to stay in the place where you're at, right? Because as you keep moving around, it makes harder for searchers to find you. And especially if you can get back to your vehicle or something that's known where you might have a few extra supplies stashed, if you're able to sit there and wait it out, especially that's where those search and rescue teams, whether from the ground or the air, at least our mountain rescue team in Colorado, that's where we'll often look for is vehicles and other things like that. And those kind of points of origin work it back there. And that's so you're much more likely to be found. However, if you're going to leave that point or leave your vehicle, you've got to know where you're going. Right? It's just like if you evacuate from your house, you know, in advance of, say, a tornado or like a severe weather event, know where you're going before you leave. Don't just say, you know, and go by dead reckoning. If you have maps or other information on the area, if you know where you go before you head out and you have sufficient time and supplies to get there, then go for it.
Very good. Jamie, your thoughts?
Well, I think, I think that's spot on good advice. Generally, the thing that's made the difference in this particular scenario, I think, is that no one knew where he was. So when you're making a trip anywhere, especially across areas that might be considered more wilderness areas, I think it's important to notify a friend that I'm going to make this journey and I will get back in touch with you at the other end of that journey. If you don't hear from me, here's my planned route of travel. And if you don't hear from me, you should probably report to the authorities that I might be in some kind of trouble. Same thing if you're evacuating in the face of a hurricane or something. If possible, notify family that you are evacuating, your planned destination, and when they can expect to hear from you again. And that way, people can be your backup if you do get stranded en route to your destination. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that, Kevin?
Pretty much spot on, Jamie. I mean, we always tell people, leave a plan. In all my classes and all my interactions, I tell everyone, leave a written plan with at least two people who don't live together. That way, if one person, you know, forgets or is otherwise occupied and they can't check up on you or check the time and look at the plan, you have a backup that you trust who will make that call and have the information at hand that you left with them so they can give all of the pertinent information to the rescue party.
Kevin, you had previously mentioned a device that you carry with you all the time. You want to mention that?
Sure. I actually carry a few, but I believe you're talking about the personal locator beacon, or a PLB. And I carry that everywhere, especially now. But what that does is you basically hit one button and it sends a signal up to the satellites using the SARSAT, the SARSAT COSPAS system, which is a worldwide system, letting them know that you're in trouble. It also sends the unique identifier of that device, which hopefully, if you registered it, has your name and your emergency contacts and all that good stuff. But the other thing it does is it also sends a homing beacon that can be used to find you, depending on the environment, the weather, and everything else. We've used it successfully to come within 5 feet of the beacon itself. Now, hopefully the beacon is on your person or within arm's reach, hopefully. Because, you know, we'll be tracking the beacon, not you. So you always want to have that beacon either on your person, attached to your gear, or near you. But we've used that. I don't remember the exact count, but we've used it numerous times to locate somebody who was legitimately in trouble. And that's a little bit different than, like, a spot, which typically a spot does not send your – a spot does not have a homing beacon capability. You can send some messages that you program beforehand, and it contacts a private third-party service. It's the same concept, but I have it with me everywhere just in case. I hit one button – and I let it run, and I know the cavalry will be coming.
Jamie, you had a question.
Yeah, just out of curiosity, Kevin, for people that might be living in an area that's more remote, and that makes sense to have something like that, or when they're traveling like that, first of all, how big is that that personal locator beacon as far as something that you need to carry around with you? And how much does something like that cost? I'm assuming there's a subscription or something associated with it to maintain it.
Actually, no. The device fits in the palm of your hand. It's a one-time purchase. I think the one I have costs around $250. There's no annual subscription. There's no other cost than the initial purchase, with the exception that about every between 2 and 3 years, you might have to send it in to get the batteries replenished. It's not something that you can do at home, is replace the batteries. But the Spot or the old school DeLorme, there's the purchase price for them, and they have the annual subscription price. But a personal locator beacon, you're going to buy it anywhere from $200. I've seen some models, depending on what features you're looking for, go maybe up to $400, and that's it. It's a one and done. You buy it, you own it, you register it with NOAA. You put in all your information, your emergency contacts, any additional information, like if you have a heart condition or diabetes or any condition that you want your rescuers to be aware of in the event they need to bring any special medication or rescue equipment that you may need if you're in trouble. You can put that in there as well, just so they have a heads up. So if you've been reported missing for 24 hours and you're a diabetic, you may not have your medication with you. If it has to be refrigerated, it may not be any good anymore because you may not have a way to keep it cold, or any number of factors that can be considered in affecting your rescue that you want them to know about. Again, it's a push of a button and it sends all of that information into the sky, into the satellite. It's pretty much worldwide coverage, and it's monitored by a whole number of government agencies and militaries and a whole bunch of other agencies, such as FEMA, DHS, the Air Force. And regardless of, it doesn't matter what your feelings of government stuff are, these are the actual government entities that are there to help you and to affect your successful rescue.
Joe, how often do you run into these during a USAR environment?
You know, surprisingly, not very often. I think that a lot of people just don't know about them. I would assume that the hardcore wilderness folks that spend an awful lot of time hiking or mountain climbing, et cetera, probably pretty astute on these things, but it would be great to see them take off like, you know, GPS and cell phones so that folks would have that capability.
There you go. I think it sounds like a very good thing if you hike and you are in the wilderness at all. Jamie, well, let me throw this out. Any other questions on that scenario or what Kevin had said from anyone?
So I've got one more comment, Sam, and that
okay,
is...
Okay, go ahead, Joe.
I think if your plan is to leave your vehicle because you're stranded, et cetera, I think it's a good idea to leave a note at the vehicle that tells people what direction you went in and when you left and those kind of that kind of information, just so that if someone does actually locate the vehicle, they have an idea which way to go looking to try to find you.
Very good point.
And that's going to wrap up this episode of the Disaster Podcast. We're going to split this one again into two episodes because we ran really long talking about these different scenarios. So we're going to split this one up. And I just want to thank Kevin Ryder, Dr. Joe Holly, Kyle Nelson, and Sam Bradley for coming on and kind of discussing some preparedness issues. And if you want to hear some more very interesting and challenging rescue and wilderness type scenarios, you'll definitely want to check in for next week's part two of this episode, where it's several different scenarios and each of our team members kind of chimes in with their thoughts, how they might handle a given situation, or what was done right, what was done wrong for a given rescue. And so we'll follow up on that for next week. In the meantime, I just want to remind all of you to thank Paragon Medical Education Group for their continued support of the Disaster Podcast. Remember, you can check them out over at paragonmedicalgroup.com. You can also find them over at paragonmededu on Twitter. And there'll be links to them, as always, in the Disaster Podcast show notes and in the disasterpodcast.com website as well. Check them out. Follow them. Let them know that you appreciate them giving us the support we need to continue to bring this show to you on a weekly basis. And we appreciate their support as always. That's it for me. I'll just remind you to check back here for next week's episode, which continues this one. And be safe. And remember that disaster preparedness is not your everyday preparedness.